Nice to see you all on a warm summer evening, accommodating the conditions of the room and being able to relax together is a very important attribute of the Dharma, and I want to actually just wistfully spend a little time talking about that component, because it has it's directly related to what I'm speaking about tonight, which is equanimity. I remember as a young monk having, of course, spent almost all my life in the West and having been nourished in the environment of affluence. Although we weren't wealthy, we certainly, as a family, had sufficient. But then going to the East, and particularly India, and I remember one point getting off a train in Calcutta, and it was the winter cold months of Calcutta, and across the field from the train station was an empty place, looked like a parking lot, with heaps of garbage that were about three stories high. And in the garbage, people have burrowed caves because of the composting warmth. They are taking refuge from the cold in the garbage. And I, many times in India, as I would walk through the conditions that I was seeing, I almost was brought, many times I was brought to tears, but sometimes I couldn't hold it. My eyes just couldn't meet it, couldn't meet the experience of the pain that I was seeing. People dying on the streets. And at that point, that would have been about 1979, 1980, there weren't the homeless people we have now in this country, and I wasn't used to seeing homeless walking over bodies in the early morning along the streets of Calcutta, where some 30 or 40,000 people slept with burlap sacks on cement. And just the conditions of human existence was brought home to me so starkly, with such starkness in contrast to where I had been raised, that when I eventually came back to the West, I decided to fast one day a week for no other reason than to remember or connect with the experiences of poverty and hunger that I had seen all over Asia for those 4 years. But when I came back to the West, interestingly enough, I saw the West from a new perspective as well, as you might imagine. And I saw equal inward poverty here, although the affluence was beyond measure in Western and Eastern terms, and that even the poorest of the poor here in this culture would be middle class in some of the countries like Bangladesh and India as well. But I felt a deep sense of inward poverty that wasn't true, believe it or not, in the other countries that I had traveled in the third world and in Asia. A deep sense of loneliness, of a kind of way that we had mastered the sense of control through our affluence, through our purchasing power, through our co-opting the high percentage of resources that this country does. The kind of an arrogance of power and the way that that led to a kind of a bitterness and encased loneliness is as close as I can reach it with words. And I could see that, given the level of poverty and the conditions in one culture and the level of inward poverty in another, that conditions were just the given of life, that they didn't necessarily bring happiness. Now, I know virtually in every beginning Dharma class or course, or somewhere on a retreat, you will hear that conditions do not bring you happiness. How many of us here in this room, I challenge you on that point, know that your happiness does not depend upon the conditions of your life? So easily we bypass the cliches of Dharma, thinking that because we have heard them so frequently, that we now know them and no longer need to really ingest their meaning deeply. Because unless we do, there will be this nagging sense of ourselves that we just haven't pursued hard enough with the right intentionality, with the right degree of ambition. And that if we worked a little harder, we could bring up the conditions of our life so that we could rest in some kind of contentment. And the search for contentment in this culture is the equivalence of the arising of equanimity in a meditative sangha. We look for some meeting of sufficient conditionality so that we can rest, so that we can relax, so we can say this is it, like the beer commercial. It doesn't get any better than this. So that we can somehow relax. That's what we want to do. But we find ourselves so ill at ease because inside we know that regardless of what conditions are arising, that they're going to, they're also in decay. And so we hold ourselves in suspicion when we're at the highest. Have you ever felt that? When you're at your highest form of happiness, there's a kind of suspicion you have that this, that you can't really relax in it because somebody's going to pull the chair out from under you or the rug, whichever. And it kind of leads to a kind of anxiety, doesn't it? Because in deeply inside of us, we know that conditions are not and cannot sustain themselves. But that's the idea of vacation, isn't it? That we can arrange our lives sufficiently with conditions so that we can be at ease for a week or two. I remember as a young boy, I lived in a very tumultuous home. A lot of yelling. In the general feeling about it. And I would look forward to vacations because I thought, well, there'll be some respite to this acrimony. And only to get to the beach or wherever we were going and find that it was just as tumultuous there as it was anywhere because we all brought our minds with us. And the conditionality didn't really matter in some ways. Yes, it was nice and warm on the beach, but that's not really what I was seeking refuge from. It was to establish some sense of respite from the turbulence that I knew life to be. That we, at some point, we have to understand that the conditions in life are not under our influence. And we keep trying to assert more influence, more control, to bring them under that. And the system inevitably breaks down. Inevitably breaks down. That life, the conditions of life come forth on their own. And even if the external conditions may be primed for relaxation, the internal conditions may not be. Our state of mind, our mood, our physical condition. And that we can't wait for the lining of all of these, that one moment in which, you know, everything crosses at the x-axis, to rest. The Dharma student must thoroughly understand that point. Thoroughly. So that there's no external reaching for internal satisfaction. Not in mood, not in thought, not in physical sensation, and not in external circumstances. Then we are ready for equanimity. Up until that time, we are playing the spiritual game, which is often a game of conditions. I had a beginning class that just happened, and at the very first day we met, we were all kind of cramped in Keystone. So many of you know that room, and about 100 or so of us. And because it was hot and stuffy, and several people just got up and walked out. And we got, they had paid their money, so we got notes that said, you know, unless you find another room, I'm never coming back to that. That's serious. And we want our money back. And I don't know how you could possibly cram so many people, on and on. And I thought, well, there it is. I mean, that's what they... Eventually, the meditation would address if you had stayed long enough. But the unwillingness to stay, the unwillingness to open to the conditions, the unwillingness to relax with our ideas, from our ideas. And that inevitable search for contentment. I came back here after several years in Asia. And the first thing that amazed me was hot water. I had gone 4 years without a hot bath. I couldn't believe people were taking hot water for granted. It was so... I mean, when your eyes wake up to what we have here, and to how routinely we take what we have here, and how we go to sleep with what we have here. It's just beyond belief. The conditions of our life. And you see, at some point, when we realize that to exert more and more control, to influence the conditions, will change circumstantially our external environment, but will not genuinely allow us to rest, which is why I read that poem, to the still point. It will not bring us to the still point. Then the only possibility is to meet those conditions head on without opposition, which is what we're doing when we're trying to discover or control the conditions. We're not meeting them head on. We're opposed to them. We're in argument with them. And at some point, the willingness to meet the conditions, to meet the existing conditions without argument, you can feel the power of that turnaround. It changes everything in life. And it changes one's disposition to everything in life. And we begin to actually, for the first time perhaps, connect, which is wise view. We begin to connect. We begin to touch life, the fabric of life, perhaps for the first time. When we're in the process of adjusting the dials, we are as far from connecting, interconnectedness, as we can possibly be. And as far from stillness, because what drives the turning of the dial is the constant noise of our expectation, of our wanting and our fearing. This then is a talk on equanimity. Equanimity means balance, but not a controlled balance, not a fabricated balance. Although each of you could find in your mind, because there are resting places for a fabricated equanimity. You do long, prolonged retreating, you will find mind states that are equanimous beyond measure, places that seem so unmoved. I was in one of those spaces one time. I was in Burma doing a prolonged retreat, and we were the first, myself and another were the first Westerners to be allowed into Burma for longer than a week for years, years and years. And we were the first Western people who were ordained there in probably generations. And so they had one of the monks follow us everywhere to make sure that we weren't going to foul up or something. I don't know why he was following us, but he was following us everywhere. We'd be sitting in the meditation hall, his head would poke in to check on us. So, and he was always trying to get us in line, and you know, it was really an awfully paranoid place to be. So I hit this place of equanimity, and I decided, because the dogs in the monastery were just starving, I decided to take my food and just eat a minimal amount and then serve the rest of the food to the dogs. And this monk who was tailing us didn't like me doing that. So he just came out and just railed on me and just started, I can still remember him, just, you know, frothing almost at the mouth as he was. And I just was absolutely unmoved, untouched. And I said, oh, this must be where the practice leaves you. It's not. That state too is based on conditions. That state too is propped up, is managed. Very delightful. To touch that. I mean, when you touch something like that, you want to ask whether it's conditional, to know whether it's the thing or not, right? Because we're always looking for the thing, right? and you can be fooled because we don't know, and so we have to ask that question: is this the thing? Is this awakening? Is this what it means? Just remember that if it's supported by conditions, which means you can leave it, even if you can return to it, if it can leave you, then it's not the thing. And the mind is wondrous at being able to present secondary rewards. Not the thing, but pretty good. But you want to be on top of that, because we do not want to rest until we have freed ourselves from all conditions. The releasing of ourselves from all conditions is the unconditioned. The still point, where the dance takes place. And so equanimity is a balanced mind, but not a mind that is balanced because of conditions. It's more, I like the word homeostasis, which means coming to equilibrium. You know, if you leave something alone in nature, it will come to equilibrium. Therein is equanimity. Leaving yourself alone, you will come to equilibrium. You will not be fabricated. The natural movement of life is to rebalance itself. But we won't allow ourselves to be left alone, will we? For the most part, we're continually poking and pushing, if not inwardly, at what expectation we have of ourselves, then externally, at what expectations we want from the circumstances of life. And so we're constantly jarring the natural balance of things. You see, the sixth factor of enlightenment, which was samadhi, you remember, was described as that steady container, that oneness of mind, that steadiness of mind. So why isn't that the final step? Because the final step is the awakening itself. The final step is the releasing of the walls of the container. So there are no walls. So that everything is touched by its open stance. Nothing is fabricated. Nothing is made into something that it is not. And when we reach that place, when that place is reached, because we don't reach it, in fact, for anyone to claim ownership and to say, I have, is to cause ruin to that space. When that state is reached, from the factors of enlightenment that we have been talking about now for these weeks together, those factors, which the factor of mindfulness, which is the awareness itself. The factor of investigation, which looks and uncovers and finds where and what is causing the dissatisfaction and the willingness to go into pain and to bring a restful, peaceful response to that pain. The energy that is derived from that exploration. The interest and rapture and calm that come within that exploration as we release our resistance to more and more of the areas of pain in our life. And the stability of mind that is that becomes that which is no longer in pain, that steadiness, that oneness of mind that is no longer divided against itself or creating argument needlessly, ends with the willingness to be completely fluid, without boundaries, where the borders of oneself can be crossed without any demarcation. Here's what the Buddha said about this. This is in the Sutta Nipata for those who are interested in such things. You see, now, what we have to understand in going into this particular quote is that the mind that wants and fears creates its wants and fears through individuating out experience, knowing things to be what they are so that I can prop myself up against them, so they can be useful, so that I can divide up thingness in the world. And so when most of us look out with our eyes, what we see from our normal consciousness, which is not in equilibrium, is things that we either care about or we don't care about or we fear. And so most of our lives are divided and split by that differentiation. But a mind that is no longer an argument sees very differently. And so the Buddha says, there is a state where form ceases to exist. It is a state without ordinary perception and without disordered perception and without no perception and without any annihilation of perception. It is this state where one can rest. Where thingness and the need for thingness, when the need for thingness recedes, and the fear of thingness recedes, because when one has investigated one's mind, we see that there is nothing to fear in experience, no matter what the experience is. The only thing we will ever fear is the ability to have an experience. Because all of life is an experience. How do we experience life? As an experience. As a seeing, a smelling, a tasting, a touching, or as a thinking object. So when we have sought out and investigated and looked with composure at each experience as it's arising in my meditation, in our life, and we see that virtually no experience need be feared, that we can handle any experience, because all an experience is this much, as Ajahn Chah said. It's only that much, he said. That's all it ever can be. What we have always feared is not the experience of life. Most of us could handle that fairly easily. But what the mind interprets about that experience, that's where the forms, that's where it gets out of reach. That's where it's beyond our ability. And everything that we fear is created not from the experience, but from that mental reactivity that makes it much more than it really is. So as we begin to investigate and look at the level of experience to see, well, I can feel this. This is okay. This emotion can be felt. And I don't bring the story in about how terrible I am with feelings of anger, or how cowardice I am with feelings of fear, or how lonely I've been my whole life when I feel a little lonely. It's just the experience. And when I see people crowding around one person, I don't think, oh God, nobody likes me. That's not the experience. But as I begin to be able to hold my inward experience without the elaborative effect, the proliferation, that confusion, the entwinement that we give experience, just holding it, then I see that there's nothing to fear. And what the mind does when it sees that is it releases the need to itemize it, to particularize it, to individuate it, to separate it out. And as we have looked again and again at all facets of our experience, there is nothing that need to be feared. And as we see that nothing needs to be feared, then what we call normal perception of individuated objects ceases. Does that mean that everything kind of homogenizes and becomes a blur? No, that's not what the Buddha said. It is a state without ordinary perception of thingness, thingness is my words, without disordered perception where chaos reigns, and without no perception, blacking out, and without any annihilation of perception. Everything is just the way it is. But nothing is made more than what it is. You see, it's always been there. I always love the fact that the day one when we sit down on the cushion, the teacher or whomever instructs says, the purpose of this practice is to see things as they are. We go, right. And at the end, we suddenly understand the way things are. And that's the end. That's the end of the story. So equanimity or balance of mind is not fabricated. It's in the art of relaxing. It's in the art of understanding, because I've now investigated everything within myself that holds any potential for it to be other than an experience. And it lies within the growing sense of trust that it's all safe, that it need not be feared, and that the sense of me no longer needs self-protection, because a component part of the understanding that arises is that the itemization, the separation, the individuation of things, the specialization that we have given life, was the reason that I needed to be around at all. And with the willingness to release ourselves from that need, the sense of I also is released. That I was a protective mechanism, a defense necessary, or what we thought was necessary. And then when everything is safe, the sense of I, the sense of self, is no longer needed. And everything comes back into its original form. And when it all comes back into the original form, the conditions of life continue. Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, that doesn't change. The conditions of life continue. There's a great story in the Buddhist literature about a man who comes in and asks a question to one of the monks of the Buddhist time, and the monk was sitting in meditation and just didn't arouse himself to answer, and the man went off very upset that this monk ignored him. But the man came back the next day and asked another monk the question he had intended for this first monk. And the monk that he happened to connect with was a very erudite, philosophical man, and he went into an elaborate detail of the answer, which infuriated the man, and the man stalked off the second day, only to come back the third day. And this time he chanced upon Ananda, who was the attendant of the Buddha. And Ananda had heard about what had happened to the first two monks. So he was going to give just the right size sermon. He wasn't going to give too much. He wasn't going to give too little. So he gave the medium discourse. And the man got very upset with Ananda because he was being superficial with a very important topic, and stalked off. And so the three monks gathered around the Buddha and they said, what do we do, Buddha? I mean, we did what we can. And you said, you have done nothing wrong. These are the conditions of life. What comes at you is not your responsibility. What comes at you is not your fault. Find the place in yourself where there is conditionlessness and let the conditions play forth. For they always will. For as long as we're alive, they always will. Equanimity can be so mistreated. I really have avoided the word for years because I have seen in my colleagues, in my students, many people, when you offer that word, they're going to find some chamber in their mind that allows them a safe harbor to the conditions of the world. And we can find that. In some way, you can find that pathologically, in disassociation. As a child, I can remember being yelled at to such an extent that I would go to a place in my mind. It was like looking at the wrong end of the binoculars, the distant, like way back in there. And it's just by luck that I didn't stay there. Just by circumstances that I wasn't trapped, because it was such a delicious place to be, free of any of the pain. I could find that place again. There's no question. But now I know what it takes. I know what conditionlessness is. And I know that that state is a separation or a detachment or a disengagement from life. And equanimity is not any of those. It's not a disinterest or disengagement or dissatisfaction or a detachment. It's not a separation at all. It's a full embrace, a full release of any resistance, and therefore a complete safety in all conditions. And it is there that we take our seat in practice. Let the conditions come. What are conditions but just the play of experience? We can feel that. Keep it at the level of experience in anything. And all things are just that much. The deepest sorrow or the highest peak experience, it's just that much. Why seek that which is so limited when there is so much more once we understand and release ourselves from the seeking? In the final chapter of equanimity, we realize that equanimity was simply resting, not moving, not being jarred inwardly, not reacting to whatever experience arose. And therefore, there was never two in equanimity. There's not a person having an equanimous experience that is unmoved by the experience. There's just one thing, aliveness itself, in the middle of things, in the presence itself, undisturbed presence, abiding presence, abiding equanimity, not fabricated. This is the direction. This is the pointing. This is what the Buddha's words were pointing to. May all beings know that. Can we sit for a minute or two? One of the qualities of equanimity is that you can hold suffering without taking it on. And most of us feel so incomplete in knowing suffering is arising without taking it on. We think that unless we take it on, it will show a lack of caring, that we have to somehow immerse ourselves in it so that we don't lost our boundaries in order to really show caring. But equanimity is very different than that. It feels the pain and knows the cause of pain. The wisdom is very deep in the seeing. And sometimes the best action taken is to leave the person in their suffering. And not to romanticize it in whatever action we take. Not to beat our brow. Today is the 60th anniversary of the bomb that fell on Nagasaki. Saturday was the 60th anniversary of Hiroshima. As we reflect upon that, what do we want to make of our life? That is the worst that one species can do to itself. And at the same time, this weekend, there was an article in the news that is the best that this species can do to itself. There is a Russian sub with a few people on board, maybe seven, that was ensnarled in some transcontinental cable or something. And the sub had limited oxygen supply. And it came out on the news that countries were just rallying, sending ships and support, finally freeing the sub and the seven crewmen from the fate of suffocation. It was a story that was compelling to me. Not compared to the 70,000 or so lives that died in the bomb of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. But in the quality of the human heart to respond . One was a mental derived event some 60 years ago, the implications of which and the anxiety of which has continued for 60 years. The other was a spontaneous eruption of the heart. How can we let seven people die? Never mind, how can we kill 70,000? That's a mental, but how can the heart let seven people die if you can do anything to prevent it? So we need, each of us, somewhere in that continuum of our inward argument, our self-debasement, and self-criticism, and the opening of our heart to ourselves and to others. And as we more and more move into the realm of that intuitive sense, not losing ourselves in the configuration of what the view we see and all of the differences that that view implies and all the prejudices that come from those differences and all the embroiled feelings we have with the prejudices and the wanting to eliminate. Not that, but the intuitive sense in our heart that knows the unity. That's where we're moving. Let us be clear. there any questions or comments? Yes, in the back. Yes, this person's question has to do with two examples I gave. One, when I was yelled at as a child, and I'm making my family into monsters, and they weren't monsters, by the way. I'm just where I practically went into dissociation, and the one where I was a monk and was in a quantum state, still in conditioned quantum state. How those two were different. They're different. One was definitely an aversive pullback that. A fleeing from turbulence that I just was too much for me. And I see the mind has the ability to do that, to flee, and to make reality smaller and smaller in its fleeing, in its safe harbor, an area that can't be touched. The other one was not a fleeing. It was it held the sense of me, which was the reason that it was conditional. It held the sense of I, but it wasn't basing the I wasn't basing its posture on seeking pleasure or avoiding pain. But the I was very much there. And in that, so that state wasn't complete. It wasn't without boundaries. And I'm sure that if somehow the I had been threatened in a different kind of way, then there would have been an explosion out of that equanimity into whatever reactivity it needed. But the conditions were right for the I to be able to quietly sit and hold the sense of watching, but not a dispassionate watching. That's as close as I can come to an answer to that. But those states of meditation do arise. And you, at times you see you be unflappable. There was another time when I was sitting and walking in the forest of southern Thailand, and I thought, you know, I'll never react again. This is it. I really thought that was it. I was going to declare myself, you know, awake and then leave this monkhood. Well, then I got in the train and went to Bangkok. And as soon as I got on the train, it was, oh, the noise is so, I can't, you know, what's, and who's that, and why are they doing this? I lost it. But in a specialized environment of the monastery, I thought, I can handle anything in here. The wind blows, I can handle that. It was as bad as it got. Mosquitoes. The state of equanimity is not fabricated. It is not built up. There's not a watcher of it. There's no owner of it. It's the natural state, the abiding state, the state of homeostasis. When left alone, when the mind is permeated with attention and presence, but left alone, then it finds that. And much of the work that we do early on in our meditation practice is to find out how to leave ourselves alone. To leave our minds alone. We're constantly doing things to ourselves all along the way, forcing ourselves into our known image of criticism. We just don't trust it. We don't trust this thing. I mean, if it came down to a single word, it would be non-trust. I don't trust leaving myself alone. And yet the whole of the meditation and every instruction that we've ever given, at least that I've given, in the heart of hearts, it points to, directly or indirectly, leaving ourselves alone. When I realized that as a monk, there was a point where I had an insight, oh, I should just leave the mind alone. Don't demand anything from it. It was such a revelation. Other questions or comments? Yes.
So you said that equanimity is like striking a balance, and it seems like, you know, I'm hearing some sort of non-attachment, that whatever it is what it is. So then the question I have, and I'm not sure that I can phrase it right, is how do you strike a balance between, certainly, you know, if you notice children playing and they're giggling, it's easy to take on that delight. And then if you think about the people that, you know, had to find shelter in a mountain of garbage, it's easy to take on that pain. And I feel like I could hold either one, but how do you strike the balance?
How do you strike the balance between small infractions of, like, the weather changing, and huge emotional turbulences like seeing the death of a child, or poverty with such abject poverty that you just... it's really the same process. It's not a question of losing... it's only the sense of one's image, that our image gets lost in something. What we feel we should do, but we don't have the empowerment to do. Our limitation of power, our anger at the government who induced this, our sense of righteous indignation for how much one country has and not the other, our sense of needing people to need us so that we move beyond our sense of into an enmeshed boundary entirely. That it's around me that we lose this, that we lose our composure. The situation still calls for action. It still calls for a remedy. And the mind does, body does what it needs to do in whatever way it can. But it doesn't carry the image of its incompletion, of what it can't do, of its disempowerment, of its anger, of its finger pointing. Although it may certainly vote in accordance with the justice issues that it holds so dear. It's really a matter of how we romanticize what we can and can't do, and how much of a trail, of a trace we leave behind in everything we do because of that romanticization. Life doesn't request that from us. It doesn't ask that. Our cat doesn't have any of that. I mean, just watch an animal sometime. It doesn't have any of that. I do some yoga in the morning, and sometimes I'm standing up. I have two chairs, and I have my head between the chairs, and my legs are straight up. And the cat walks in, and it looks at me, and it's just like, well, that's just normal. And he walks, goes to his food bowl. He's unflappable in terms of, I could be doing anything at all, and it would just... you know, and we're saying, oh my God, are you in pain? Do you need something? Oh, can I help you? You know, the cat doesn't do that. There's something to that. Yes.
So you're talking about sometimes the most beneficial thing in listening to somebody or in sitting with somebody who's suffering is to just sit with them in their suffering. So how do you respond when somebody's looking at you saying, what should I do, or fix me, or help me, or they want a verbal response?
Yes.
They want you to give them an answer.
Yes. So how do you work with somebody who's leaning on you for some advice or some answer or something, some response? You know, so many times in with the dying, when you're dying, you know, you would love to have a remedy. You'd love to have something, you know, something that you could offer somebody so that they could feel better about their situation. And sometimes people would ask for that in ways that they knew were impossible, but would ask for it anyway. And they would ask for it sometimes in a way that, like, do you think I look better today? You know, some way to encourage that there may be a turnaround here or something like that. And so you can feel the pain of the question. Right? And if you have an answer, an appropriate answer in that particular moment that can be helpful, then to offer it. But when a dying patient says, don't you think I look better today? My refrain back to them was, well, what is your body telling you? So that I wouldn't give them false cues. So that I wouldn't take away their pain necessarily. Right? Or give them hope beyond the reality of the situation. And there's a way that we govern our responses to pain that always waits for us to be able to, you wait for somebody to meet you in such a way that they're ready for a pointing to how they could hold their pain. That sometimes happens rather spontaneous. But if the readiness isn't there, you don't force it on somebody. And if they're asking for something that's completely unrealistic, beyond your abilities, beyond your empowerment, then to hold their pain of the question. And you often find a response coming not in terms of responding to their question, but responding to their pain, which is really where the question is coming from and what really needs attention. No, no. No, no. No, no, no. No, I won't let you go any further on that one. It's not to transcend this existence. It's to abide in this existence. Fully. We're not transcending anything. We're abiding. The truth is that these conditions are the only conditions. There aren't any other conditions. There's no other option. If there was another option, I'll take it. There isn't another option. There's this or there's suffering. That's the option. So you either abide with this, or you create an alternative reality in which you will suffer. Now, that takes training, because most of us, the worse it gets, the more we flee. Because we've only known how to flee the existing conditions in our life. We've only learned that. It's everywhere, in billboards, television advertisements, everywhere. We learn how to flee. We haven't learned how to abide. And what we're learning here is how to abide. Okay, so we have to stop with that. I want to thank everybody for their attention. Next week we will have a discussion. Then we're going to start a new series at some point along the way here. We're going to have some Dharma dialogues and things just to kind of... Then we'll start a new on distortions of mind, I've decided. Because next year, I'm going to spend practically the entire year on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I'm going to just go into the thing, and we're just going to look at everything that could possibly come, so we can just, everybody know that one really thoroughly, until new people come.